Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking Irish history. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and a man who I wish kind of was Irish history at this stage.
I am Irish history. I'm old enough to be Irish history. Look, before we get into this, we're having a live podcast. This is, I can't remember how many live ones we've done now, but great event. It's going to be in the Wiley Fox on the 22nd of next month. You'll be able to get your tickets from Eventbrite, or you can get on our website there and you can find where the tickets are. This is going to sell out fast. It's actually selling out. Tony rings me every day and goes, so many tickets gone. So it's selling out fast. So get in there quick, get your tickets. Great event. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to seeing y'all.
That's the plugging over, right? We're much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Check by actual podcast royalty. Finn Dwyer of the Irish History Podcast is here. Finn, thank you so much for coming. We dragged you all the way to the north side of Dublin. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. Thanks very much for having me on. It's great to be on.
I know. It's one of those people you interact with on social media and it opens the world in its own ways. And this is one of the real good things about social media, that you can make these interactions because you're someone who some of the stuff that you've done in terms of just not just podcasting, but and actually, how do I put it, making history accessible via the medium has been something that I've admired for a while. You're nearly 10 years at it in a couple of weeks. When you started, did you envisage that this was what you were going to be doing?
Definitely not. I started making podcasts actually because I got a chronic illness in 2009 and I wasn't able to work for a couple of years and I was just really bored. So a couple of podcasts that started, there was like Hardcore History by Dan Carlin, and Mike Duncan was making a series on the Roman Empire. Anyway, I just decided I was always interested in history. So I decided I would have a go at making a podcast in Irish history at that time, just to keep myself entertained. And it grew from then. So I had no idea at that time that nearly 10 years later I'd be sitting here.
So you mentioned Dan Carlin, and I actually quote Dan Carlin quite a bit to Martin, because Dan Carlin makes a famous quote about his, someone said to him, "Oh, you're one of the biggest podcasts in the world." And he said, "Yeah, after 50 years of work, I'm an overnight success." And he has, that is one of my favorite ones that he said. But in terms of, you looked at it and said, well, I'm interested in history. This is a medium to do it. And I'm just going to put my, put the work out there.
Yeah. When I started making podcasts though, like the first conversation I'd have with someone is to explain what a podcast was. Like very few people, like it was tiny. Like there were, I don't know how many podcasts. I know Niall O'Nine had a podcast before I did, but I'm not sure there was many others. There was a few. So you'd have this problem that you'd have to explain it to people. And then I think 2015-16 was when it really started to change. Serial was a really big moment. West Cork, after that, was another big moment in terms of Irish podcasting. And then I think something that was really significant was when Blind Boy started making his podcast. Those three things opened up a wider audiences in Ireland to, or I think they kind of served as gateways, that people heard about these podcasts, wanted to go and listen to those. And obviously then once you listen to one, you put the app on your phone, it's much easier then.
But you're being a bit modest about that, because you predate all of these bigger podcasts per se, and even the people like Blind Boy referenced you very early on as one of his favourites. And, the work that went in, if you say they're the gateway, that would kind of make you a kind of a trailblazer.
I don't know, maybe a guy wandering around in the wilderness waiting for somebody else to come along might be more accurate. But I think since 2016, it's been a totally different. Like it was before that, like 2016 was where I was able to start making a living, comfortably, and stop worrying about whether I just had to give it up completely. Because you just had that audience out there.
And why history?
Well, I was always interested in history. I suppose that doesn't necessarily answer, though, why people listen to it.
More interested in why it was the subject you decided to go with.
Okay. I think history is, I think it's very instructive to life today. Even the past, I think it actually serves two almost opposing purposes. So there's one that it could be escapism, like if you're listening to something about the Middle Ages, that lots of the experiences of people then are so far removed from the problems that we face today, things like violence or hunger or these things that are very much part of daily life, that we find maybe so different that it's a way to like escape from the problems that we all face. But at the same time, there's also, you can listen to stories from the past, and people often have similar, like human beings haven't really changed that much. We live in different contexts, but we haven't like evolved or anything in the last, like since history in Ireland has really begun. Like, you know, there's not, you know, so you're talking about people like us facing very difficult situations and how they respond. So I think it can serve two purposes. And like what I'm really interested in, I guess, is crisis points and how people react in them. So like I wrote a book on the Black Death, and then I've just finished, or I'm recording soon the last episode in a series I've been making about the Great Famine. And I think actually the two events are not that dissimilar, where you have this like moment in a society where everything you considered, well, like where a certain section of the population considered as the basics of life are taken away from you. And like the future is totally uncertain. Whether you'll make it to the future is totally uncertain. It interests me how people react in those situations, good and bad.
Which is obviously very pertinent, because we talked only before we started recording about how history is now becoming an optional subject in secondary school. And, you know, the concern of that is obviously when you talk about crisis points and the fact that we haven't really evolved, there's no guarantee that our progress is always forward. If that's,
no,
you know,
like I think actually we have this idea that history does move forward and that it always progresses. And once you dig down into it, that's not the case at all. If you look at history of the 20th century, say from even a bit before it, from the 1880s, 1890s, where you can start to see the emergence of, say, for example, things like trade unions or maybe peasant movements in the later 19th century arguing for increased rights for what we call poorer people. They make huge progress up until the First World War. And if you were around in Europe, say, in the early years of the 20th century, you would think that things were going in a really good direction. Couple of years later, these people who are actually, you know, people in Germany are working with people in England who are working with people in France. And within a couple of years, they're slaughtering each other on a battlefield in a moment they thought would never happen, because you start to see the emergence of internationalism. So what at one point seemed like this great hope just descends into horrors. And then generally speaking, for example, in Ireland, in the women's experience is one where it's not a story of progression at all. In the early 20th century, you've got this powerful women's movement that plays a very important role in things like the 1913 lockout, the War of Independence, all these events. And then in the 1920s, they go through this horrific experience where you have a government that comes to power, Cumann na Gael, which are very, very conscious and clear about the fact that they're going to drive women back into the home. So history, I think that's a really big, from my perspective, a really big warning from the past. It's like the things that we think are a given now, like healthcare, things that life expectancy, none of this has to, there's no reason this has to continue.
And I'm going to quote an old pal of ours, Sam McGar, we're on a timeline to extinction. I mean, we are on it. It's how we're getting there. And we do repeat quite a lot in our history. And there's a lot of repeating going on now, particularly on with nationalism. And we only had Trump's speech yesterday at the UN, and he was very much about patriotism and nationalism. And that's echoes of 1930s, but there's echoes going back further then to pre-World War One as well. Same kind of echoes.
I often think of in terms of the global financial crisis of 2008 and onwards. And I think it was Plato who said interest, because they always said money was the, you know, the evil device in the world, and that interest means money born from money. And they, you know, and that was the, so people go, oh, you know, this is the way we repeat things. Well, some of these things are just going on and on, even since the Greeks were writing proper philosophy about it. I called it earlier, your opus on the famine, and it really is, like, I mean, it goes into such detail, different geographical locations, different individual stories, and there's real granular detail for it. You got the trouble with some of the things you've done where you've had people voice characters, and you've had, you know, these make it real, though, make it accessible for people. You also are guilty of making Peg Sayers more cool and hip. Defend yourself.
I think Peg Sayers, I think she's a fascinating person who is actually a victim of Irish politics of the 20th century, where her life was just taken and they forged this thing that she wasn't, to teach people Irish, but also reinforce this idea of what an Irish woman was. And Peg Sayers is actually, her lived life is a fascinating experience. She wasn't the person portrayed in the book Peg that lots of people would read. And she...
Or don't read.
But I think it probably wasn't a suitable book maybe for the purposes of what they tried to do to teach teenagers. Hmm. Like, she lived a very difficult life. It's not like a lot... And you get... Certainly, when I went back to, you kind of get the impression she was probably depressed for quite a significant period of her life through horrific experiences of losing her husband, losing kids, and then living on the Blasket Islands. But it's this fascinating story. Like, if she lived today and wrote a book, it'd be up there with, like, those kind of, like, survival books you hear about. Like, how do you do that? So I think her life is fascinating. And in terms of the famine, I think it's probably the most important thing that's happened in Irish history, and it's totally forgotten. We've had a decade of centenaries for the 1916 Rising through, that's going to go on until 2021 with the War of Independence. And I'm sure there'll be something about the Civil War, but I'd say Fine Gael won't want to talk too much about the Civil War. But I think the famine is far more important than any of these events. And obviously, I think we should acknowledge the decade of centenaries, but that event that took place in Ireland between 1845 and 1852, 53, whatever end point you want to put on it, changed this country forever. And pretty much all the major events that have happened since then, like the War of Independence, like the Civil War, I think are probably outworkings of a lot of the tensions that built up during the famine. The relations that between Ireland and Britain are definitely today still haunted by that experience. You can see it on Twitter all the time, that, like, what is the first thing that Irish people go to is, well, that happened and it was on your watch. What's odd is that Irish people don't really understand what happened. They know it started in 1845, that it ended in the early 1850s, that a million died and a million fled. I think there's very important lessons, though, about what actually happened in those 5 years, about things like economics, about racism, about how Irish people treat each other, about how, and it's not just Irish people, because what happens in Ireland is not particularly, like, it's unique in that the type of famine that lasted that long, but it's not... You know, there are people all across the world have experienced, like, from China, Ukraine, Africa, like how many countries in Africa have endured this? And it's not, like, not a historical event. No. I'd say in, like, East Africa at the moment, like, several countries in East Africa at the moment are facing, you know, each region, each place has its own dynamics, but it's not dissimilar to what happened here in the 1840s.
And I think it stays in the memory, it doesn't stay in individual memories, but the memory of the country, it stays within the memory. Even little things, food. You know, I know when I was a teenager, you couldn't leave food on the plate. You were doing something really wrong if you left food on the plate. And that, like, my parents didn't grow, but my grandfather was the first generation, we'll say, after the famine, or close enough to the first generation after the famine. Yep. And they valued food so much. They valued food. Yep. I mean, it was, we kind of squander food now. They never squandered food. Food was really, really important. But I still see with my dad, you don't leave food on the plate. There's something wrong if you leave food on the plate. You can't do it. And I think that's sort of an inherited memory that they have that came through the family.
Well, they've shown that trauma and the history of trauma is generational. It's not just, you know, it's not just the people who are directly impacted. It travels down through.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think Irish society didn't deal with it afterwards for very understandable reasons. The people who survived the famine had been, famines are way worse than people think they are. Like what a lot of people think a famine is that you, food runs out. Certain section of the population starved to death and it eventually comes to an end. Famines in reality are much more like a war where food starts to grow short for reasons often that people don't realize. It's often to do more with markets and your ability to access the food. But regardless, your ability to access the food starts to, say, diminish. And what people they do anything. Hunger is one of the most vicious things you can imagine. Mm-hmm. People will do anything to get food. So that often at the start, it's more collective solutions like protests, riots, things like that. And as the situation deteriorates, then it turns in on itself. So you get families taking food from each other and then like into the really extreme situations and the isolated cases of things like cannibalism. Mm-hmm. But that's more the story of famine rather than this kind of like almost, we have this image of kind of the noble victim that just like takes their fate in a kind of stoic way.
Heads for the coffin ship. And
I think when you think of it more in the reality of it in these horrific situations, then you start to go, well, why? I understand now why those people, you know, if you survive that, you've got to rebuild a society that's in ruins. You don't have time. It's not completely, we have this idea that they didn't talk at all. They did. And actually you can see it in Peg Sayers that she remembers being told stories, but there wasn't this open conversation where it was dealt with. And then in the 20th century, people didn't deal with it largely in the later 20th century because of the North. And they didn't want to blame the British government and bring up this issue. If you cannot have an honest conversation about the famine without discussing the role of the British government and what they did and didn't do in the 1840s. And in the later 20th century, when the war in the North started, historians avoided it because they'd say it now that they didn't want to write what they considered provisional narratives of history, in a reference to the Provisional IRA. Like, that's just a bizarre thing to do. Like, because if you don't understand the connection between events like that and not discussing them and the situation that was developing in the North in the later 20th century, the two aren't unrelated. They're not, I'm not saying it's a direct, but like the two are clearly related, that experience of Irish people in the British Empire. My point is that this has all led to the situation where we've got this very vague understanding of what happened. And I think there's very important lessons, I would say more important than the lessons you would learn in the Irish War of Independence.
Absolutely. Like, and the formation of the state. And we talk about these things. And then you touched upon the treatment of women and how that was put upon. And now we see, you know, we see even now where they're talking about still sealing records for people who were illegally adopted and never been able to find out their own things. And we've seen, you know, calls for sites of conscience to be developed so we can actually have these conversations and have a place to memorialize them and talk about them and actually own what they are. We always say we never really own our history correctly in Ireland, particularly not when it relates to a lot of these things. Some of it is out of convenience and some of it after a famine a lot of that would have been out of necessity.
Yeah. You know, I think like what you're touching on there though about sites of conscience, and I think that's really important, and it's very different from, like, there's a big debate about how you memorialize the past, say, like the War of Independence or the famine, and like some of the memorials to the famine I think are a bit crass and they don't help us understand and they're often factually incorrect. I think that issue of those things, like when we talk about, like, say, Magdalen Andries, that's not history. No. Obviously part of it is, but that's they were still operating when I was a kid. Yeah. Like, and most people, I would wager, listening to this, mightn't realize it. But the last one closed, I think, in 1987.
Gary Gannon did a piece on it about the woman who escaped.
During the World Cup, the US World Cup, she got out of a Magdalen laundry. And she escaped, but she was out a couple of days and she needed to go back because she just couldn't.
But the fact that this went on very recently, and there's needs to be treated in a different way. I mean, I think what you're talking about there, part of it, I guess, is an apology.
Like,
you know, and
And an apology, though, without an actual acknowledgement in terms of the, of putting in the correct context is just an apology. It's sorry you feel that way.
Yes.
Can't have that. What we actually have to have is, you know, this is what happened. This is where the religious institutions were operating. This is where the state facilitated this. And this is where, you know, if your name is Martin McMahon, but your actual name, your birth name was Roger or something or other, you should have the right to know that, yeah. You know. And
but also, I think what's an important discussion to have in public is what Irish people, the general public, knew about these institutions. Mm. Because there is an idea out there that no one knew anything, and that's just not true.
Nonsense, yeah.
It's people, and that doesn't mean that we have to, like, get our grandparents and, like, blame them and, like, but we have to face up to the fact, and, like, a lot of people, and it's understandable, the power of the Catholic Church was terrifying in Ireland in the 1950s, say. But there's no, we can't say to, like, people who suffered in those institutions going, oh, well, we didn't know. Mm. But, like, we all know. Mm. That wall was there, and, like, for example, that they would, when they would be brought into class, they would be sitting at the back of classes and things like that. People did know, and, like, there was in areas references to the abuse that went on in these institutions in the surrounding communities. Mary Raftery researched this and gave loads of examples about how people knew. And also, like, on a governmental level, the extent of knowledge of abuse varied from, say, generation to generation. But in the 1920s, there was 1930 to 31, the Carrigan Commission investigated child abuse in Ireland, for example, and detailed that it was a really big issue. Now, they weren't looking at the church. They were looking at familial abuse, which actually is a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. That we don't really face up to. But they detailed the extent of it. That report was suppressed at the time and wasn't published. Like, very few people saw that until the 60s or the 70s. Mm. But my point is it's important to understand all the layers of how this information was known, because we have this idea that it was the church and the church did it in secret, and that just makes no sense.
Yeah, that's, like, that is literally the issue of, if you know, when you arrive in Amsterdam, for example, and you do the you can go and see the sites where the German occupation were, and they talk, and they're very honest about it. They say how efficient the Dutch state was in processing Jewish people, because the civil service of the machinery after the Germans arrived was simply just taken over. There was a new guy in charge, but they used how efficient that the civil servants were to process Jewish people off on trains to meet their debts, but at least there's an acknowledgement there.
I think so. Look, and I think the worst thing in these situations is to do what large sections of our society are doing and going, well, this is just the church's fault. Mm. And yeah, like, of course, there's power dynamics that existed in Irish society in the early 20th century that you have to acknowledge. And going, if you were from parts of Ireland and you raised your hand against the church, you would be ruined for it. That said, it is interesting. The Communist Party, for example, in the 30s raised this issue publicly in their newspaper at the time, calling for an investigation into Artane. So, it, again, my point is that there were people at the time. That was the Communist Party. They were already at the periphery of Irish society, and essentially they were calling into the wind, and no one would listen to them. But yeah, I do think that's a really, and it's like, there's a whole issue around abuse in this. That there's another conversation. We've had a conversation and it's really good and it's a start. But if we stop that conversation now, it's not like we won't have, there's an opportunity to, like, right an absolutely terrible wrong. And it's not like, I'm not saying that we need to be going, oh, everyone is guilty equally, because that's useless, because then no one is guilty. You know, if you do that thing of everyone is guilty, no one is guilty.
Yeah.
But it's about going, yeah, look, I was powerless. I couldn't act, or I'm a human being and I act how human beings act. And then hopefully, though, you could change it for another generation going forward.
Yeah, but we haven't. And
And
that's where I was going to come in. We have no great Catholic Church wielding power now at the moment. And yet we are repeating what we have always done with women and children in poverty. And everybody knows that direct provision and housing hubs exist. Everybody in the country, you can't live in this country but know that they exist. But we are all a party to it. We are all apart. We are simply repeating what we have always done, is hide them away, warehouse the poor, convict them of being guilty of poverty.
Yeah. I think I'm not into like a hierarchy of oppression, so I'm not going to say one is worse than the other. Mm. I do think the conversation, though, that it's around direct provision is potentially really corrosive, where you have a section of Irish society defending that. Very few people defend homelessness. Mm. Now, they're not to necessarily come up with solutions, but if you have people defending direct provision, just given what's going on there, that's where that leads would worry me quite a lot.
Yeah, well, like, absolutely it does. And we've seen there are bad players, there are bad actors. It's a scary situation. And, you know, we need real leadership as well around this. We can't have comments made about, sure, people can just get up and leave. It's not, you know, we can't have that conversation. We can't have those talking points, because those talking points will then be taken by these bad actors and actually used to portray this myth of the great replacement theory and that nonsense. But anyway, look, we've really digressed, because and it's great to have this conversation, because it's great to pick your brain. It's great to be able to do it. But coming back to what we spoke about just before you came on, you were also talking about doing things around some individuals and revolutionary individuals, some of those individual stories. A lot of work must go into finding these people.
Yeah, it can. And actually, sometimes it just starts by, like, you know, I could be reading a general article in a newspaper, from the 1930s, and you just see a name, and maybe just a comment in a newspaper article beside a name, and like, whatever, just something tantalizing. And then you go off and trying to find out about that person, like, and initially just, you know, going into an ancestry website, maybe just to find out when they're born, when they died, then following them. And then sometimes it goes nowhere, and they just turn out to be a boring person who once said something interesting. But then sometimes, you know, they'll have files in the National Archives, they'll have intelligence files, maybe even, and getting to read that stuff is incredible. Like, it's a fascinating insight into the past. And sometimes, so I'm doing stuff at the moment where, like, it's people involved in quite conspiratorial stuff on the far right in the 1930s, and actually a problem that I'm having is actually saying this is actually true, because it sounds so crazy, because it's like, it's almost like an Indiana Jones film. Like, you've got like really evil Nazis and like conspiracies to like destroy the world almost. Well, not destroy the world, but like you have these people operating in ways that are almost cartoonishly evil.
Yeah.
And trying to go, no, this actually happened, and these people did, and they were obviously highly destructive people. It's actually proven a challenge at the moment to make it.
Do you come up against barriers? We'll say you're looking at stuff from the 1920s, 1930s. Do you still come up against barriers in secrecy barriers and stuff that's difficult to get through?
Yeah, I would say that once someone is dead, I don't believe that there's a reason to
protect them.
Yeah, like if files are, for example, exist, I do think there are reasons, for example, that the state shouldn't release files on people who are alive. There's very good reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, I mean, now private citizens, like politicians that are alive don't have that. Like, we all have the right to know. But like, if, for example, the Gardaí are keeping files on someone who's alive, that shouldn't be released to the public, because, as we know, the guards can be very overly
concentrated in an area.
Yeah, like, you know, there's no good reason for that. When people die, though, then it's I don't see the reason. And you do have this, like, someone that I'm researching at the moment is dead, has been dead for nearly 30 years now, and that file is
sealed.
And I don't under, like, you know, there is rationale. Like, you
of
know,
course there's a rationale, like, but it doesn't, but that rationale, it's very much there. Like, we've spoken to people who are frustrated in the current system of trying to get even modern day stuff. And there's no real interest in the corridors of power to change a lot of this, because there's always their own reasons for wanting to keep things.
I mean, I think oftentimes, though, people with power, it doesn't have to be a conspiracy.
No.
It can just be that, but naturally in those situations, you're going to be, I don't know, you just don't want change, because, like,
conservative.
Yeah. It's almost even beyond that, in that, like, just defending the status quo, because, you know, change just nothing good in a way can come from change, because change means new information coming into the public domain, and you probably don't want that. It's like, you mightn't even know what's in it. There might be nothing in it, but it's like, why would I potentially risk anything by doing this, you know?
I've actually seen that myself. I've seen that it took me 20 years to get a question answered. It took 20 years to get a question. Well, a very simple question, but it took 20 years to get the answer. And I'm like, fuck, man. You could have given me the answer. It wasn't that big a deal. So why take 20 years to give me the answer? Why take 20 years?
Yeah, and I think sometimes it is that thing of not, like, it's not that they're necessarily going, oh, you can't have this specific piece of information, but it's just, it's better just to like.
I think their default position.
Yeah, that's it.
The default position is protect the status quo.
No, the default response is no. Do you know what I mean?
And then you need to prove yourself. How determined you are.
Yeah, and then we've got to work backwards from there, as opposed to, you know, this is just the apparatus. And we're seeing it more and more with journalists coming up against it. We're seeing it more and more with all of these. In the new world, where it's going to be so crazy, because everything is, there's so much life online now, you know, imagine being in
I've talked to people about this a bit, like, it's, so now, you know, like, sorry, previously you would just go in terms of like archives, you know, you might have someone's private, even if they're not a public figure, they might have had, you know, people in the past would have written letters, and people were quite good at keeping their papers, and then they would often towards the end of their life or be submitted to an archive, or maybe their children would go, oh, well, my whoever, father, mother was high involved in significant events and here, and, you know, and you can go and read them. And that's the case, you know, the National Library is full of people's
stories,
memories and, you know, things like that. But today, like, people could have 5 email accounts. They might tell people about 2 of them. And correspondence could be on Facebook, it could be on Twitter, and it could be in emails, and it could be in WhatsApps. And the same conversation can be happening across all 4 platforms. And I think there's going to be a really big problem that, like, you know, when people die, there's no access. And, you know, even if we see, like, would you want your Google account to be opened at any point ever? Like, and then, like, because you've got, like, all your, you know, so I think all these, this is going to create a really big problem in the future. But then again, maybe in 100 years, there won't be. I have a funny feeling humanity's concerns in 100 years' time might be more on the future than the past.
We're still, I'm up the top of this mountain surrounded by floodwaters. If I die, no one look at my Google.
Developing gills. It is interesting that so much stuff is online these days, that we are losing a paper history of stuff.
Yeah.
And we are very much losing a paper history of stuff. And stuff that's online isn't necessarily there forever. It doesn't exist forever.
Totally based on potentially a company staying in business.
In business, yes, exactly. We do lose, and we are losing. I mean, I've in this week, I'm actually dealing with like 20 years of work, and I have it all on paper, but it's a full wardrobe that I need, and I'm looking at it and I'm going, do I keep them, do I throw them out? There's stuff in it that's relevant, there's stuff in it that's not relevant. I mean, going through it is a no-no, an absolute no-no, because I'm not going through it again. I've been through it so many times. But do you chuck it, do you keep it? And I've kind of decided to keep it.
I think so, like, you never know what.
There are little gems of research in
you
there.
You don't know what it could be for somebody else. Like
a piece that fits in someone else's puzzle.
Exactly. It's just that like tiny little piece of that could totally, like, someone else might have 99 of the 100 pieces, and you realize it.
And I know
the 100th piece, like, you know.
And I know this isn't anecdotal either. This has been discussed, that in government levels, decisions are now made verbally.
Yeah.
To avoid FOI, to have anything on paper, they make verbal decisions. And so you're also losing records, paper records within government of decisions that are made.
I'm sure, I don't know, I'm looking at this off the top of my head, but, like, you know, like, you've seen The Wire where they have the burners. Yeah. How many governments use burner phones? Like, where they get, like, a series of phones that, like, and they just bin them. Like, you know, if you were doing something nefarious, like, using your own phone at this stage. I couldn't believe it that they're actually asking, like, that Johnson and them wouldn't hand over their WhatsApps, where they obviously discussed it. And it was like, what's wrong with you? Hmm. Like, that was the first thing, surely, that someone would go is go, we want the phones.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually all those conversations around Brexit will be interesting, because obviously they had very important conversations, and in 30 years' time, say a decision like that, that's going to need to be, it'll be very important.
Picked apart, yeah.
And some of the crucial decisions, whereas if you go back, like we're talking about the famine, if you go back to British government decisions taken in the 1846, 47, 48, 49, and really important ones, decisions that would ultimately cost tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives, it's pretty easy to see where the decision, the idea starts, and then how it moves up, who the key player maybe is. He lobbies, say, for example, you look at Trevelyan, you can see him formulate an idea. He's a civil servant in the Treasury. You can see him write to Charles Wood, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Maybe Wood brings it to Cabinet, so you can see this. Whereas, maybe something. Yeah,
Boris's WhatsApp group was going to be called What Dominic Told Us, or something. But we're being flippant. But there is that awful.
But I think it'll be gone.
Right? Yeah. And
because the problem is, do you want WhatsApp to turn that conversation over? Because then the logic is like,
it's all fair yeah. game.
But 100 years from now, we could be looking back on this period, not us, because we won't be here, but other people could be looking back on this period, and it's actually going to be a black hole for data. There's going to be nothing there.
Yeah, I think it's probably not the first time, and I'm not talking about a very specific example, but like technological changes, you go through these things where people move from one technology to another. And like, if you think the internet and say online communication is really maybe 20 years old, like it only really became a mass form of communication in the late 90s. And I do think all these problems are going to be like, there will be checks and balances probably brought into them. I always think if you think about, the early days of, say, when newspapers started coming out, and literally people said almost anything in the 19th century in newspapers, like wildly slanderous stuff about people who are too poor to fight back. Like, and some of the stuff would be off the wall, or I love a home. There was two newspapers, the Kilkenny Journal and the Kilkenny Moderator. And the two of them had this ongoing feud where they just wrote horrific stuff about each other on the front page of the paper every week. But then eventually it kind of beds down.
Send tweet.
Things, and some, it doesn't necessarily always have to come from the top. It's people, you can probably see that, maybe with some of the conversations that do go on Twitter where people try and check really outrageous behavior, I'm not saying it always works, but there is, I think, a growing, hostility to things like, the worst toxicity of the internet is hemmed into 4chan and 8chan now. And
it is actually.
I think a lot of that stuff, people who do that don't feel comfortable anymore.
Mainstream, yeah.
Yeah. And there is problems to that, but, you know.
We need to work through all of that as well, because the only way to do that is you can't have these people who we see who maybe aren't comfortable, as you said, in popular discourse. You can't give up on people either.
I'm saying that as someone who
you talk about it and you go, oh yeah, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't actually try. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't actually try and get these things in understanding. And part of that is understanding our history and what happens when we disenfranchise people.
I think it is, we're talking about, I suppose, one of the big conversations we're probably talking about is, that would kind of revolve around this is around immigration. I think because you can kind of see it all across the world where this kind of like almost as a red herring, the far right are using this, and often it's not an issue. Like if you look at the amount of immigrants in Ireland, it's like tiny compared to the amount of Irish people. But what I can't understand, I spent the last three and a half years researching the famine intensely, and I'm writing a book on it at the moment. And these people call themselves patriots and nationalists. And it's you're actually descended from people who needed to emigrate, because it's generally accepted. If you look at in a general picture, for example, of Ireland in the late 1840s, where you have high death rate, sorry, where you have high emigration rates, you tend to have low death rates. So what's essentially happening is the people who would starve are leaving. Now, what did these people, I have no interest in having a conversation with someone on the far right because, like, but what I am interested in is having a conversation with ordinary people because, like, I understand how people can be susceptible. But it's like, what makes us different? Because when Irish people went abroad in the 1840s, we were treated like dirt. People thought we were the internal enemy. We were considered violent, dangerous, untrustworthy because we were generally Catholics and that our allegiance lay with the Pope in Rome rather than whatever government of the country you went to. All the same arguments that are made about immigrants into Ireland today. And it's like, do you not learn anything? Like, you're essentially having a conversation with your own great-grandparents.
About yourself. Yeah.
And like these people call themselves patriots or nationalists. Like, it's a stupid term.
And the other thing too is that Ireland has always had an influx of people. There has always been different peoples who have come to Ireland. We're made up of so many different peoples.
I just find that whole conversation infuriating because not only is it against our past, it just makes no sense. Like the amount of immigrants to this country is not like, we're not talking about, it's a relatively small group of people and there's as many Irish people, you know, a numbers game in this, but usually, and you can see this, is like there's a danger of the fear of the unknown. Like I think obviously you always go back. The worst case of this, obviously, is Germany in the 1930s. Mm. But what I always find a really interesting statistic is that in Germany in the 1930s, the Jews were less than 1% of the population, and most Germans in rural areas had never met a Jew because, say, 10% of the population of some of the big cities were Jewish. So what it is actually, it's not that, like, you know, you have this idea that maybe Jews were quite prevalent in society and maybe dominating, you know, certain aspects of society. And this is what led to some sort of like,
as opposed to the truth. Sorry to cut in, but as opposed to the truth that they were actually barred from certain aspects of society.
Before they were really barred, they just were a largely invisible group in society. And actually German Jews were very acculturated. So like they tended to be quite nationalistic in terms of, you know, they'd served in the German army.
They were actually conservative Germans.
Yeah. And I think what I find instructive, sorry about that, is that someone can largely invent a story that has no basis. You know, like I think I used to always think that like these things needed a material base in society that they had to like, or sorry, not a material base, but like they had to have a factual.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Like, they don't.
You can just totally make up a story. Like, it's like, you know, the story of like, asylum seekers get a free house, free car, and like a gold watch. And it's like, just sit down and think about that one. Like, just sit down and like, just like, you go away and think about that and like, go down to the social welfare office and ask for the form where you get the free house. These people are some of the most impoverished people in society.
But I suppose the world's view of Ireland and the caricature of Ireland is the drunken Irishman and the wife-beating drunken Irishman. When, okay, some of it we have to own, some of it we do, but that is not Ireland, nor was it ever Ireland. The Irish people emigrated to America, to the US, and they actually built those countries. They were a very, very productive group within society, a hugely productive group.
It tends to be the experience of immigrants.
Absolutely.
Like, immigrants tend to, I think it's more about the experience of you arriving in a place, you know, you don't really understand the system, so you have to, in Ireland, if you're like, say, born here, you probably understand the social welfare system a bit better. You understand, if you're all these things, so often when you're an immigrant, you don't have this. So, like, and also you're often may have like relations at home really need
dependent on you.
Yeah, dependent. Like, and like that's the big Irish experience actually in the 19th century.
The money, the American money.
Like, there's quite a lot of studies. Well, not quite a lot. There have been studies done as to how much of the Irish economy, like, and it's a couple of percent of was based off dollars coming back from the US. We're not talking about like 10 grand here. Like, we're talking about millions flowing into Ireland. in the all through the 19th century. And like, you know, people talk about chain migration, all that, like, that is Irish people almost invented chain migration.
We did. Yes, yeah, we did.
Like, so like, look, we can't, like, if you want to give out about this, you're having a conversation with your own great grandparents. And there's literally any stereotype that you've heard about, say, particularly today, Muslim people tend to be the people who are the target of the, like, every stereotype was the one made about Irish people. Yeah. Violent, that was made about Irish people who were actually running a dynamite school in New York at one point.
Yeah.
You know, like, but that's besides the point. That was a small group of Irish people. Like, it's all these stereotypes against immigrants are the ones that have always existed.
I always go back to, is it Thomas More's speech in the play about Grant, you know, the one Grant them removed, where the mob want the immigrants removed in London. And he goes through, you know, the police are charging with batons and let's take them out. And he says, no. And then he goes, but if I decided now that I wanted you out and we sent you to France, what would happen to you? What way would you like to be treated? You know, I've seen Ian McClellan do it, and it's just a powerful retelling of it. But I always think of it, you know, we talked about the Jewish experience in Germany. We can talk about the Jewish experience under the Romans when they wiped them out as well. You know, there was one phrase that was used: leave none who can piss standing up, was one of the phrases was used. So, you know, literally not one male child was to be left, was one of the instructions given. So, yeah, I suppose I want to be hopeful, but there's always that phrase where we say, the one thing we learn from history is we never learn from history.
Yeah, I do think, though, there are, like, while we were saying earlier, history is not always progression, huge leaps forward have been made. Now, the thing is, can we defend those? Because And that's the thing, you have to defend them, because if you just leave them, you'll lose them. But like, there are amazing things, like the 8-hour day that was unimaginable.
I'm glad you said was, because it's gone.
I don't think it, like, we're not back. I think there are things about, like, workers' rights that are still quite heavily, people believe that they're at least entitled to these things, which is a much bigger thing. Like, say if you look at, like, rights in the 1860s, 1870s, like, where people were working, like, to death. Like, in a lot of industries, you were working to death in factories. And that was just an accepted fact. Whereas today, or maybe, like, and I'm not saying, like, workers' rights are under attack. There's no question about that. But I do think there's a general, what I'm saying, I guess, is that things have improved.
There's an expectation and there's a floor that we haven't fallen below.
Yeah, I think so. But even, like, looking at other issues, like the two referendums, and, like, those two referendums, I think, were the end point of much more important struggles. Like, obviously, the referendum on choice, for example, that was just clearly came when Irish society had long moved on. When you look at the actual vote, it was up at nearly, like, it was nearly 70%. I think, wasn't it? Or 68?
Like, if you broke down, and I did, I broke down the figures, and if you broke down the figures when it was 51-49, you're looking in the 90s.
Yeah.
You're looking in the 90s is when it would have actually passed. And it took society another 20 years, or not society, it took government another 20 years to catch up with society.
They only did it when they felt that there was nothing to be lost and only things to be gained. And then, but I do think that represents a major change.
But it also represents, I'm glad you pointed out that these rights are not, cannot be taken back, because only yesterday we saw President Trump stand up in the UN, mention the rights of the unborn, and mention that other states couldn't interfere in what, and that was a clear shot to that he's going to, you know, he has now loaded his Supreme Court with conservative judges, and they may take a run at Roe versus Wade again.
And I think that is probably a real warning, maybe in Ireland, because, you know, before, like, say, 10 years ago, when you would have had conversations maybe about this issue, you would have talked as Roe versus Wade as being this, like,
iconic,
landmark moment. Whereas now, so, like, the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, like, that doesn't mean that. Now, you know, it's hard to envisage in Ireland where you would have a movement of that size that would
undo it,
but it would probably have been impossible in America in the 1980s to, you know, they existed, but you'd go, those people will never have the purchase on the levers of power because they weren't even influential enough in the Republican Party, to do that. And now they are. And like, you can see, and I think probably maybe a greater litmus test of this might actually be more around around gay rights.
Yeah.
And I think, maybe I'm wrong, but like, I think that would be where those people would go for first.
Well, we've seen it in states like Charlotte, where they, you know, some of the bathroom laws and things like that were, and you know, that's where it starts. It creeps in that way. Last thing for me, and it's a little bit off kilter, outside of the wider span of history, what does Finn do? What's Finn into?
I was talking to someone about this recently, and I'm actually just becoming a very, very boring person. what do I do?
You're like Martin, so.
This is really bad. Like, you know, like, what do I do? What do I like doing? I like walking. That's pretty boring, though. I have a terrible taste of television.
Right.
Really bad.
But so you mentioned The Wire.
That's, like, seriously highbrow for me. Like, I'm not actually going to say it because it's so bad I'm not willing to admit it on that.
it's expose, we know.
Yeah. it's not expose, but it ain't far off it. God. I'm going to come back. I'm going to go away and like think about my life after this.
Accidental crisis.
I was asking. I like our lab pubs.
You seem to like Kilkenny anyway.
I love Kilkenny. Kilkenny is a great spot. If you're living in Dublin and you are, footloose with your work and you're not, most people are, but if you aren't, look outside the M50. It's a bright land. Culture's come home.
But you don't even get to drive through Kilkenny now, the bypass.
No, you don't.
Yeah, it goes right past.
It's great.
Yeah. Well, it is and it isn't. When I used to drive down the West Coast, you used to drive through all those little towns and you'd stop off.
I think that actually it is a really big problem for, and it's not, like, obviously you want to be able to get to places, and in terms of like industry and things like that, it does make sense to have rapid communication. Mm. For small towns in Ireland, it's killing them. Like,
it is, yeah.
In Kerry Castle. It's in North Kerry. But it used to be on the main road between Limerick and Tralee or Killarney.
Mm.
And it's been bypassed now. And literally the main square in the town is like just boarded up. And you're looking at it going, there's no way back for this, actually. You know, because it doesn't have...
No.
You know, it's kind of a market town. Mm. For the a regional market town.
When I was growing up the road, there used to be Santry Woods. Martin, you would have been born in them, if you remember. and you
planted them.
Yeah. But you used to have to wander through the woods. But you could go right through the woods and then come out on the other side, and the Swiss Cottage was there, because Dublin was surrounded by inns on the roads. That's that come right. in. And I drove past it the other day and it's gone. And of course, all Santry Woods now is just...
It's that beautiful park, actually.
Mostly apartments now, you know, Northwood. But nonetheless, my point being, though, like, you know, when you see the inns are gone, that used to be the main arteries to the city. Now we just have a Woody's on every artery. We put a Woody's on everything. But look, Finn, people need to go check out, I don't need to tell people, you've all heard of the Irish History Podcast, you all need to go check it out. You also need to support independent podcasts, okay? Finn is on Patreon, it's patreon.com/IrishPod, and he gives great content there for people who are giving the few bob extra, you know?
And just while you're at it, we're there as well, yeah? just the slash and then Tortoise Shack, you'll find us there, throw a few bob in, and remember the live show coming up. Finn, thank you very much for coming in and having a chat with us today.
Thanks a million, lads. It was great to come on.
Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.